And welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to continue our conversation now with U.S. Senator John Thune. With fewer than 20 days before Donald Trump takes office as President of the United States, we wanted Senator Thune's perspective on the possibilities and challenges of a new administration. But first, we wanted to know what he admired most about President Barack Obama. And of course, since this week we greet a new year, we asked for Senator Thune's advice about making time to get in that morning workout. Take a listen.
Let's talk about other priorities for the year legislatively. What are you looking forward to about the President-elect Trump taking office and a new Congress coming to work?
Well, what I'm looking for and hoping, and I'm as a member of Congress, look forward to working with a new team. I think there's always a period where there's hope and optimism and a chance for sort of a fresh start. But I'm hoping that there'll be a very singular focus on the economy. And what kind of policies can we put in place that will increase the rate of growth in our economy? Because when the economy is growing and expanding, it's creating better paying jobs, wage levels come up, people's standard of living gets better, and that helps solve a lot of other problems in our country as well. So I'm hoping that he'll be looking at what can we do to roll back some of the heavy hand and cost of regulation, what can we do to reform our tax code, to repeal and replace Obamacare. Those are a series of things that I think if the new administration would focus on coming in, that would really make a big difference in terms of creating more growth in our economy and better paying jobs and higher wages.
What are some of those conversations about Obamacare and repeal and replace that are sort of happening now that we're going to see the effects of going forward?
You know, I think that most people, 80% of Americans, according to this was a Gallup poll from a couple of weeks ago, said that Obamacare either needs to be repealed and replaced or changed significantly. So you've got 4 out of 5 Americans who acknowledge that in its current form, it's not working as intended and it needs to be significantly changed or repealed and replaced. So that conversation is underway. Anything that we do will be with an eye toward doing no harm. We want to make sure that people are not harmed by any of the changes that are made, but that we give people more choices, create more competition in the marketplace. That always has a downward impact on costs. And, the thing that you probably hear the most from, at least in South Dakota, when talking about health care, is just the cost of people's health care insurance and how it keeps going up. Mm. Premiums are skyrocketing, deductibles, co-pays, any out-of-pocket costs, and they want those to be reined in. Well, the best way to get some of those costs under control is to create a more competitive marketplace and give people more choices. So most of the things that we're talking about in terms of policy changes would be with an eye toward what can we do to get the cost down, and give people more choices and continue to provide the kind of quality healthcare opportunities that we have in this country today, but hopefully do it at a much more affordable cost.
Are there key elements that people want to keep, key things that they say, well, we like that, and that's something that we need to save?
I think that there are some things that probably will stay in place. That, clearly people have pre-existing conditions. You don't want to deny them access to coverage. And so, the ban on denying health care coverage for people with pre-existing conditions is something I think that's sort of universally agreed upon needs to be maintained. There's some discussion about allowing, kids up to age 26 to stay on their parents' health care plans. And some other things that I think probably are sort of bipartisan, mutually agreed upon features of that would be retained. But I think that you're going to be looking at some significant changes in other areas of Obamacare. For example, the federal government in Obamacare, in law, decided to define what health care coverage is. And so now you have all these mandates that every plan has to meet, and that just continues to escalate and drive up the cost. And it takes away the choices that people have to get plans that fit their particular circumstances or needs. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll see significant changes, but perhaps some things that, features that may stay intact as well. But by and large, the main components, the elements of Obamacare will be repealed and hopefully replaced with something that works much better.
Congress has had some time to think about, talk about, work this over. How prepared are you to hit the ground running on that topic?
Well, I think there's been a lot of good groundwork done, a lot of foundations laid. But anything like this, where you're making significant change, you have to have a transition period. And so we would assume that any change in terms of repealing Obamacare and replacing it with something else would take place over a period of time. And again, the first principle that we want to observe is do no harm. And so whatever we do, there will be a transition period that phases in those changes and phases out the existing law in a way that hopefully minimizes any disruptions in the marketplace, maintains a stable health insurance market, and hopefully moves us in a direction that actually does put downward pressure on rates and on costs, because ultimately that's how I think most Americans are going to judge whether this is a success or a failure, and that is, can we actually do something to bend the cost curve down and make health insurance coverage for people in this country less costly.
As we look at the final days and weeks of the Obama administration, can you put that in context for us? Were there things about Obama's term in office that you think were particularly successful in how he worked with Congress? And then maybe we can talk about some of the criticisms. But first, as we say goodbye to Barack Obama, what are you going to remember about those 8 years?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that, you know, this president, which I appreciate, has not been dogged by any kind of scandal in office, which I always think is commendable. I think I can disagree with his policies, and I do on a lot of levels, but I think there are some areas where, he has done some things that hopefully will be positive in terms of his legacy. I do think there's going to be, as you mentioned, you talk about criticism, an awful lot of criticism of his foreign policy, sort of record and things that he did in his time in office that have made the world not more safe but less safe. And I think on the domestic front, obviously, Obamacare is something that will be a big part of his legacy. And I think that, too, is being acknowledged by most people, as I said before, something that's going to have to be revised significantly, or it's not going to stand, obviously the test of time. So, but I think that, I have enjoyed, on a personal level, I've always said I like this president, on a personal level. And I do think that, he has, throughout the course of his administration, conducted himself in a way that hasn't lent itself to any kind of, personal or scandal in his administration, notwithstanding the policy differences that we have.
Less safe today. What needs to be addressed immediately to right that course as you see it?
I think, one, we're going to have to do some things to rebuild our military, and I think we're going to have a different approach when it comes to America's leadership place in the world. Being a world leader doesn't mean we have to send troops everywhere, but it does mean that we are the entity that people look to in terms of economic power, military power, diplomatic power and leverage, to put together coalitions that will help combat some of the threats that exist to our country's safety and security going forward, and to the world's for that matter. And I think that's going to require a different approach in terms of what America's role and place is, and the kind of leadership that it provides in what is increasingly a dangerous world. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it's going to be restoring, rebuilding our capabilities from a military standpoint, and then just how we engage in the world when it comes to national security and foreign policy issues.
From what you understand so far about President-elect Donald Trump and his transition team, are you encouraged by some of the choices he's made, or do you have concerns there in that regard, in the regard of national security?
With regard to the national security team, I think he's made very good choices. I mean, General Mattis, I think, is a great pick for Secretary of Defense. I think that I don't know. He hasn't. I think that his name, the gentleman that he picked for Secretary of State, also is somebody who has a lot of experience in negotiating with foreign countries, knows all the world leaders. These are people who I think are very experienced on the world stage, and I think will take us in a different direction. So far, I think the picks have been strong. I don't have a quarrel with any of the people he's put in place. I do think that he's picked a number of generals to lead intelligence agencies, and as I said, the Secretary of Defense, and I think those are they're people who are viewed with great respect, not only in the military, around this country, but I think generally regarded as very capable leaders. And that's what we're going to need going forward. People who not only have experience, but also have the leadership capabilities that that can really reassert, I think, America's place in the world, and ensure that we're not leading from behind, but leading from the front and trying to make the world a more secure and safer place.
I had not heard of Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State choice. When his name was announced, I had not heard of him. Had you, and did you have a positive impression of his ability to do that job?
Well,
he's been a question mark for me.
Right, and I think that, you know, he's going to have an opportunity through the confirmation process to answer a lot of hard questions. I think there are a lot of people who probably aren't all that acquainted with him, but the people I do know who are acquainted with him are extremely impressed with his leadership, his knowledge. And, you know, he's been somebody who has been a decision maker, been a negotiator, and has built relationships with a lot of the world leaders. And granted, in a different capacity, working to try and do business in a lot of these places, but he's got experience in Latin America and the Middle East and Asia and Europe. So I think he's somebody who has, the people, like I said, the people who I know and respect who have weighed in on the Tillerson nomination are extremely impressed by the choice. So we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Like I said, we'll have an opportunity to hear more from him when he goes through the confirmation process. But I think that for the most part, I tend to try and give presidents a good amount of deference when it comes to assembling their team and putting their cabinet together. And, the early, I think, readout on Mr. Tillerson is quite positive.
I don't know if you're a worrier or something. Worry is the right word. Do you worry about anything with Donald Trump as president? There are areas that sort of wake you up at night and you think, well, we got to watch out for that. Is that not in your human nature?
No, I'm kind of a worrier by nature. I mean, I do look at the world and I look at the threat matrix that we face in the future, and you try and project over the horizon and figure out, what are those challenges that we're going to face, not only in the near term, but in the 10-year window and beyond. And I'm not just worrying generally about, I'm not saying about the new administration, but just generally about the country and where we are. And I worry about the dangers that exist around the world, the potential of having a nuclear Iran. China's increasingly provocative in Asia and China and the East and South China Sea. Russia, of course, increasingly aggressive in their neighborhood. And then you've got the terrorist threats that exist out there. So, I think about those things and what we're going to do to combat them. I worry in particular about cyber threats. Mm-hmm. Cyber attacks are something that I chair the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. We have partial jurisdiction of that issue. And so I'm very interested in that. And the other thing that I worry about, too, for our kids and our grandkids is just the massive amount of debt that we continue to pile up. That really concerns me. And I think I'm, just increasingly convinced that if we don't start taking steps soon to address that it's going to become much harder over time. I don't think we can continue to kick the can down the road.
Mm-hmm. What gives you the most hope or optimism legislatively looking forward into 2017?
I think that the wonder of our matchless Constitution and its durability over time, the checks and balances that exist there, and the optimism and resilience of the American people. I still think that we're a unique country on the face of the earth, and part of that is our, we're very blessed to have a system of government that has functioned with its fits and starts, but certainly endured for a very long time. We have an economy that represents literally one quarter almost of the entire economic production in the world. A lot of people who are hardworking and care deeply about the country and believe profoundly in freedom. So I have great confidence in the American people and our ability to take on big challenges and to win. So I hope that we demonstrate that in the next few years, because we have some big challenges ahead of us.
Yeah. Let's just close by bringing it back to, sort of fitness, and not to be too silly, but obviously this is something that you sort of have down over the years. Physical activity is important to you. Exercise is something that you don't seem to struggle with. Give us some tips going forward back to that Monday and making those resolutions. How do people get started and stay motivated to keep a fitness plan going?
It's really hard, Lori. I mean, you know, you've hit it, and especially this time of the year. But if people have made, you know, resolutions for this new year, and I would just say, built it in. If you don't, it'll get crowded out. I know in my schedule, I have to put it in, and it takes a tremendous amount of discipline, because there are so many days when you just don't feel like doing anything. And part of it is just start putting into play some really good disciplines, and provide some incentives for yourself. You know, after a workout, sometimes just a good strong cup of coffee is something that keeps me kind of motivated. And I think you have to try to build in incentives into your daily schedule, and then you have to try and build in those disciplines and really sort of square that time away. Otherwise, it will get crowded out, because we all have busy lives and schedules, and it's also very hard to motivate this time of the year. But you realize that most of this is mental. Once you get going, it's not that hard. It's the mental anxiety of trying to motivate yourself to get out there in the first place.
Mm. Do you set goals for yourself personally?
You know, I not as much as I probably used to. Part of it now is just kind of maintenance.
Right.
You know, there were times where I would be training to run a 5K. You know, I want to run a certain time, and so, you know, I would train for that. Nowadays, as much as anything else, it's just kind of being able to maintain a level of health and fitness that, keeps me out of the emergency room and hopefully feeling better. I will say this, and I think this is true for a lot of people, and this is one of the reasons I would encourage people to do this as well. But when I start my day that way, I think better, I get the blood flowing earlier, and I just find myself to be sharper and crisper when I'm taking on my day. If I've done something that has it's got my heart going and got the juices flowing and the blood going. So I think in the long run, part of it's just your own, hopefully, just ability to feel better as you go through your day.
Well, we want you to be sharp and crisp every day for us there in Washington. So, Senator John Thune, thank you so much for joining us today and having a little fun, as well as talking some serious
all
stuff
right.
as well.
Well, good new year to all your listeners.
All right.
So thanks, Lori. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day. You've been listening to U.S. Senator John Thune. After the break, detailed advice on starting the new year by focusing on our relationship with food and with our bodies. Dr. Steve Herman is up next. You're in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We continue our look at what it means to welcome a new year in South Dakota. Up next, our relationships with our bodies and with food. Dr. Steve Herman is Senior Director of Operations for Sanford Profile. He's familiar with the nutritional and the behavioral science that fosters a healthy weight. He knows the challenges, and today he brings us a few solutions. Dr. Herman, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you for having me, Lori, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too. Hope springs eternal in January, does it not?
It does, yeah.
And we talked a little bit earlier in our program about 30% of South Dakotans being obese. We talked about only 8% of people sticking to their New Year's resolutions. Those numbers vary depending on where you get your information. But give us an idea where to even begin if one of our goals is to have a healthy weight or a healthy relationship with food. Where do we start? What's the best place?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of places to start, and I think one is trying to simplify what our goals are. We set a goal of losing weight or having a healthier relationship with food. That means a lot of different things, and to be successful, it can help to set some smaller goals or start with some smaller changes. And that's going to do a couple of things. One is when you start making small steps, small changes, and you're successful, it can build confidence to keep going and make future changes.
When you say successful, is it that you're successful in achieving the small thing that you set before you that makes a difference, or is it you actually see a result, whereas something moves on the scale, or you're well, go ahead.
Yep, it's a little bit of both. And so, setting a goal of losing weight, it's difficult to say, well, let's lose weight. But what you can focus on is saying, I'm going to eat breakfast every day. I'm going to be active when I can. I'm going to schedule it in. And so you can be successful in achieving some of those goals, and that's going to build towards losing weight. And that's some of the small things that we can focus on to be successful on a much bigger goal, like weight loss.
Why is this so hard for us? Why do so many of us aspire to lose weight or eat better and fail so quickly?
Well, I think we know it's not easy. It's a pretty complex relationship. There's usually some pretty strong habits built around how we interact with food. Some of those are generated over years and years of time and can be tough to change. And sometimes we go into it trying to do too much. Like I just mentioned, you're trying to jump into an exercise routine on January 2nd, or you're trying to lose weight today, instead of focusing on some of the key components of what might be driving that behavior, focusing on what we call the habit loop. And the first step of the habit loop is a trigger. The trigger is followed by a behavior, and behavior is followed by a reward. And that's how your brain and your body has developed these habits over time. So, for example, you see some food, you eat some food, and you feel pretty good. Hmm. And so then you see more food, you eat more food, and you feel pretty good. And then certain things can happen. Stress might intensify a situation. You might yell at your spouse or your kids or get angry when you're stressed, and you normally wouldn't do that when you're not stressed. And the same thing applies to eating. So when you're stressed, that may be a trigger for you. You normally won't eat something, and then you decide and you eat. That's a behavior, and then you feel better. So it's driving home that habit. And so focusing on the stress might be the most important thing you could do, is by fixing the stress or managing your stress more successfully to ultimately eat better.
How much help do we need in making some of the lifestyle changes that we're talking about? Is it something that you can do by yourself, or do you really need, no negotiation? You need to support people in your life, someone to help you along the way.
Yeah, everybody is a little bit different. We know people learn differently. There's a lot of self-help books out there, and some people are incredibly successful in using those. And a lot of people do need more support. So it can be helpful to have friends or family or coworkers involved in the process. It can be helpful to find a personal trainer or a class at a gym that might be helpful. It can also help to have a health coach that can navigate some of the challenges along the way.
How do I know I've got a good health coach or a good personal trainer? How do I know that I'm looking, or a good book even? I'm investing money now as well as my trust. How do I evaluate that in the early stages of it to say this is worth it to keep going?
Yeah. Well, I think that can be difficult for a lot of consumers. There's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of people promising quick fixes. And we know that's not the case, but I think over and over again, we let ourselves get talked into saying, well, if we just do this cleanse, this short-term diet, that's going to fix it this time. These supplements, that's going to do it. And so I think we need to be on constant guard against that, and look for a program or a gym that plans on being with you for long term. Mm-hmm. So it should be 6 months or a year or multiple years, because we know it takes a long time to successfully make changes and then navigate all the challenges that come up through an entire year.
So the appeal of the quick fix is that people immediately get some that reward is replaced. You see the difference right away, and then the logic behind that is once you feel the difference, you won't go back. But I'm guessing you think that quick fix isn't going to work.
Well, you know, sometimes the immediate reward is good. We just need to balance that with the sustainability of whatever we're trying. So it might feel really good going to the gym, but if we overexert ourselves, there's a chance you could get injured or you're really not prepared to handle the level of exercise you set out to do. And so that's where it can help to have somebody evaluate where you're at, set up a program that's personalized for you. And we can do the same thing on the nutrition or behavior side, is that it's not a one-size-fits-all, and it needs to be something that has a plan to take you from where you're starting to where you're going, and to take you through different steps or phases along the way, instead of starting from here to 100 miles an hour, in no time.
How do I know where I'm going? That has to be really individualized too. To say what's on the other end of this? What is my actual goal? How do you help people decide that?
Yeah, well, I think sometimes it helps to try to align someone's values and their motivation with what they're doing. I think there's a lot of people that this time of year, make a resolution because it's that time of year.
Right.
And it may not be the most meaningful thing for them to be doing right now. And so I think it helps having someone guide that to say, is that really, why you want to do this? Or why do you want to make this change? And I think aligning the values and the motivation will really help someone stay on track through this time of year and then, beyond.
So how important is a healthy weight really then? Should it be something that we have on the top of our list?
A healthy weight is important for a lot of reasons. I think there's, we can focus on a lot of different things. There's a lot of negative health implications to people who are overweight and obese. But if you have some excess weight, it can be really helpful to focus on some small behaviors. And so just having one or two healthy behaviors, eliminating smoking, being active, adding some vegetables in your diet, some of those small changes can make a really big impact in lowering someone's risk for some chronic diseases. So even if you don't achieve a normal weight, losing as little as 5% of your body weight can help reduce medications, can help improve your overall health in a lot of different ways.
How much does age play into this? And I'm asking because when you talked about overexerting yourself, I was on crutches last year from trying to run and realized that maybe I couldn't run like I did when I was 30. So how much do our goals sort of change and our relationship with our bodies change as we get older?
Yeah, well, I think you can look at it a couple different ways, and one is understanding why you're exercising. Sometimes, people exercise out of the feeling that they need to. Well, we'd like to get people to a place that they want to and they enjoy it, and they do it for the health benefits of it, and not necessarily for the weight loss, because you can go out for jog a mile today. You might not see any weight loss, but if you jog a mile and you enjoy it because it lowers your stress and it energizes you, that can have a really positive impact long term.
So go out and have some fun.
Have some fun.
Have some fun.
Find something that's fun. Exercise, it shouldn't be painful.
Yeah.
It should be enjoyable, and it should be something that you're willing to do on a regular basis over a long period of time. And if it's not, you might want to try some different types of exercise. So if running is not appealing, start with yoga. Start with a group fitness class. Do something that you find enjoyable, and it's going to be much easier to stick with it. But one of the best things you could do is find a friend to do it with.
Yeah.
That's something that I think for myself personally is one of the most effective things I do, is either sign up for something at an event, or find somebody else that's going to help hold me accountable, because I can let myself down a lot easier than I'm willing to let somebody else down.
That great advice today, Steve Herman. We're gonna leave it there and wish you a happy new year, and thanks for giving us permission to have a little fun with this as well.
All right. Thanks, Lori.
A prescribed fire in the small Black Hills town of Rockerville burned a significant number of historic buildings on Main Street and adjacent areas to the ground. SDPB's Jim Kent was at the scene as more than 60 firefighters from companies across Pennington County took part in the event.
Rockerville is located in the heart of the Black Hills, just south of Rapid City. It was established in 1876 as a Christian mining town and as an alternative to raucous locations like Deadwood, says Rockerville landowner and realtor Pat Hall.
Rockerville was the first Christian mining town in the Black Hills, and Deadwood was the first on the opposite side of the venue. It was a little more wild and cut up. The main street of Rockerville was called Ascension, like it would ascend into the heavens. And in 1960s, Rockerville became kind of a tourist town, a tourist attraction.
Primary among the tourist attractions was a strip mall with tourist shops, a live theater called the Melodrammer, and a ghost town. All have since closed. Pat Hall bought auction property in Rockerville in 2000 that included the strip mall. His plan was to develop it, a plan that never came to pass.
So Division One, your goal is to burn down those strip of buildings over there directly across from the Gaslight.
With the strip mall and other buildings in Rockerville in serious disrepair, and with the renewed interest in developing the space, Pat Hall created a win-win situation with the Rockerville Volunteer Fire Department.
You can go get it.
I'm standing near the old strip mall with Fire Chief Gail Schmidt on a frigid New Year's Eve morning.
Today we are burning down these old buildings in Rockerville. The landowner has requested that we come in and burn those down for him. We use it as a great training opportunity. So it's an opportunity for the young and the old to see how the fire burns and to practice some different fire ignitions as well as fire suppression and water hauling.
Buildings have been prepped to be burned down, removing anything that's not supposed to burn. There are three divisions or fire locations. Fires are started simultaneously on Chief Schmidt's command.
Division 1 operations, you have permission to light.
It's a clear, crisp
Division
morning.
Three,
winds are low and the sun is just rising above the surrounding treetops as the buildings finally catch fire and start to burn. Flames eventually consume the entire structures, and the intense heat can be felt across the street at the Gaslight Restaurant, where more than 100 locals have gathered to watch the historic event. It takes more than 2 hours for everything to burn down and for firefighters to ensure the area is safe. It may look bad now, but Pat Hall assures the community that a phoenix will rise from the ashes in 2018. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jim Kent in Rockerville.
Up next, a treasure trove of conversation with Chuck Anderson. Images of the Past is after the break. You're in the Moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. During his long career in radio broadcasting, Chuck Anderson recorded and saved more than 500 hours of conversations. The result is an archive of stories and anecdotes that capture the essence of our state in the voices of those who have made their lives here. For today's Images of the Past, we welcome Chuck Anderson via telephone from Huron. Chuck, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks, Lori. It's a real privilege to be with you today.
It's a privilege to be with you. I'm going through some of these radio conversations or recorded conversations online, and it's just such a treasure trove of of work that is starting to unfold. So thank you so much for bringing those to SDPB Radio in the first place.
I'm very happy to be part of the family.
Yeah. Personalities with Chuck Anderson. You can find that online. We'll say that a couple times. Let's get it right out there. You can hear all these and see lots of images that we've put with them as well. So give listeners, Chuck, some of your background in broadcasting in here on there so we have an idea of an overview.
Well, they always say you're the sum product of all your experiences, Lori, and man, I had a lot of them, and I guess that's what kind of got me through. The first thing, I can't emphasize how important to study English and speech in your local high school. Huron was always very famous in their school system for a strong English. Man, am I glad I had an English course here. And also music was really important. And that got me through to typing. Can you imagine in the old days when I was in school? Typing wasn't considered a man's occupation. It was for women to become a secretary. And however, if I wouldn't have taken typing, I'd have never become a journalist.
Interesting. Those are unexpected sort of origins there. And then how long were you in broadcasting?
Well, if you consider 1955 on up to this very day, I guess I'm still broadcasting. Right, Lori?
Right. Absolutely. It doesn't end. Talk to me about some of these people that you talked to over the years. How did you sort of decide who you were going to have a conversation with?
A lot of times, it'll be by pure accident. I'd be out at Huron's home for the Southwood State Fair, and I'd always be out there interviewing little kids. You can't get a better show than interviewing little kids just as they come off the Ferris wheel, and they're sick, and boy, did we have a lot of fun, and they're hollering like that. And all of a sudden, you run across like Shania Twain, just walking down the pathway, and you'll say, hi. You know, you try to remain calm and keep your voice steady. I'm Chuck Anderson, and of course that means nothing to her. And I said, you know, I have a radio show, and I'd just love at a break in your show if I could get together with you. And that's how it starts. But there's others that are so big in South Dakota history, like Joe Foss. I worked a couple of years on getting an interview with Joe. And I went down to Tempe, Florida, or Tempe, Arizona, where he lived, and it was just amazing. Unless you've ever met a tough Marine like Joe Foss, you've never had your mettle tested as an interviewer. Lori, if you can imagine, if you're sitting down in his living room, and he comes up and says, hi, Lori, have a chair, and he plops down on the living room table this .45 caliber pistol.
Oh.
I mean, absolutely, I went bananas. This has never happened to me before. And he says, you can't be too careful around here, Chuck. He says, we get broken into every now and then. And he says, but don't let it bother you. And the gun's staring right at me.
Oh, my. The tone was set from that.
He was such a tribute to South Dakota. I was so lucky to have caught him before he died.
Yeah.
That, you know, he was the fighter ace. Mm-hmm. Over the Pacific, and gosh, what a great, wonderful guy. Mm. Other people like Cheryl Land, she's from Huron, so that was easy. Just, you know, catch her when she's home sometime. And
I was listening this morning online to, it was Germans from Russia, the Volga Germans, and you had talked to Ted and I don't know if it's Corrine Becker, and what a history lesson that was.
I'm glad you brought that show up. That I consider that probably the hallmark of my radio career. Mm. It's if people haven't had a chance to hear that, and I know it's just kind of come online recently, it's hard to believe that something like that could happen in the world, or let's say the nation, and even get closer to home, that this happened in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
That up at some of the small towns, they went in, the authorities went in and locked the churches because they spoke German. And they had book burning parties, and they threw any book that had German. You probably, if you heard the show, you'll know how just tragic it was. And they would padlock places like schools. One day kids went to their German school, and the next day their teachers were gone. But the most powerful one, powerful story that Dr. Timothy Doncher, I never can pronounce his name. Timothy, if I say it slow, I can do it, Lori. Cloberdance. And his buddy, Dr. Harry Kulcher. They talked about Parkston, South Dakota. I don't know if you remember this part, where to make a show that all people will serve the armed forces. The colony people there didn't believe in, in wearing a uniform or carrying a rifle. They would serve. You know, they'd be cooks or anything. They just wouldn't go out and kill. And that bothered the Army so bad that they set these four guys up from Parkston Colony. They called them in, and they said, we're here to ask you to serve in the United States Army. Now, they had a member of the FBI there and the Sheriff's Department, and they weren't fooling around. And they said, we can't do that. So they arrested them and sent them out to, like, Portland, some dinky prison, where for 4 months they weren't allowed to wear clothes until they would put on a uniform. And they wouldn't do it. And then they sent them to Alcatraz, where they, it's such a sad story. They got sick, and a couple of them died. And then they were getting kind of embarrassed. They didn't know what to do with these guys from South Dakota. And they sent him home, or to Leavenworth, and then home. But before they sent him home, they called their wives, and they said, come down and meet your husbands. So only one wife could get the money to get down to Leavenworth. And she went in, and there was this coffin in the room. And she went over to the coffin, and they raised the lid, and they said, is this your husband? And it was, and they had him in a uniform, an Army uniform. And the other one was nobody showed up to be able to pick him up, Lori, and they sent him back to the colony. And they all got together, and they had a big funeral for this man. And they opened up the casket, and again, there he was in an Army uniform. And it's just, it was times like that when I was able to interview these people that I thought, boy, am I lucky to be able to have some way of exposing this. And that, you know, it could happen again, something like this. The hatred was just enormous. And I told my wife, I didn't know that you had digitalized that program, and I listened to it one afternoon. And I said, Wanda, I said, gosh, I wish that there was a way that I could expose this kind of stuff. And she says, well, you are. And I said, yeah, that's right. Well, we're putting it out on airwaves that will go all over the world.
Did you have a sense at the time you were doing those kind of interviews, having that conversation, the significance of it even then at the time?
I didn't get the question.
Did you have a sense at the time that of the significance of those kind of conversations? Did you know that they would sort of stand that test of time? Right away you did.
I felt it. There was a deep sense of regret and shame and sorrow. I felt it and I knew it. And in some places, I'm probably covering it up pretty good. My voice actually starts to crack. It just was so sad that this happened right here in South Dakota. There's another show I did that will be, it's in the pipeline. It'll be coming out soon, I think. It's out at Edgemont, South Dakota, where these poor people during World War II were taken so advantage of that they had an arsenal out there, and they buried nerve gas and mustard gas, live bombs. And eventually, as the Army pulled out, they just sort of scattered all this stuff around, and really bad things happened. I was really lucky. I was out trout fishing about, maybe early 90s, and I happened to talk to the editor of the newspaper, and he said, have we got a story for you, Mr. Anderson? And he got together some of the old-timers, and that show at the end, I just feel I didn't do enough to tell the hardships that they went through in Edgemont, created again by our own United States government. It's just, and what was interesting, I told Kara last summer, I said, you know, if we get this show on the air, I said, it's really topical because there's, I said, in the newspaper, they're still finding bombs out there on the ground.
Wow. Huh. Kara Hetland, for those who are listening, is our director of radio here at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest in the moment right now is Chuck Anderson, and you can go online. You can find it at sdpb.org/images of the past, and then on that right-hand column, there is says Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Click on that, and you can start finding your way through some of the archived interviews that Chuck did over the years. 500 hours of conversations are being digitized now and then posted as we sort of get them ready for digital content there. Chuck, give me an idea of how you prepared for some of these interviews. When you talk about meeting Shania Twain at the fair, that's pretty impromptu. Were a lot of your interviews impromptu, or did you put a lot of prep work into how you wanted the conversation to go?
Well, I always tell young people that want to be an interviewer or go into radio, You have to know your subject and do a lot of research. And if you can't, if it's a spur of the moment type of a thing, Lori, always do a pre-program interview, even if it's just for a moment or two. A good example, Doug Lunn, do you remember him?
Yes, I do.
Kelly Lynn? Well, Doug was playing in a concert up, at Brookings, and I had a chance to, I knew Doug, and I had a chance to interview him. And I went up and I says, "Hi, Doug. Let's start now. Where you're from?" It just went. Doug looked at me like the deer in the headlights. He went absolutely brain dead. Now he is one of the professionals of professionals, and I laugh and I says, "Doug, it's funny having the mic turned on you, isn't it?" He says, "Yeah." Never ask a question that you don't know the answer, or you're going to have dead air that just goes on forever and ever. It's a good question, Lori. Know your subject. Know who you're talking to. Have good manners. That is so important. Be a good listener. Be a really, really good listener. Avoid arguments. Avoid politics and religion where possible.
Chuck, we're hoping, we're going to run out of time here, so we're going to say thank you to you now, and we're hoping that you'll come back as some specific interviews get archived to talk about the individual conversations that you had with folks. Would you be willing to do that for us?
Would love to do that, Lori.
Chuck Anderson, thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it.
My privilege.
That was Chuck Anderson. You can find those interviews as they begin to be archived online, sdpb.org/images of the past. Look along the right-hand side there and click on Personalities with Chuck Anderson. That is our program for today. I want to thank all our guests. In the moment is our content producer is Steve Zwemke, technical producer Chris Loffrey, executive producer is Kara Hetland. Thanks also today to SDPB's Victoria Wicks and Jim Kent. Tomorrow on the program, U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. Plus, it's been just over 10 years since the execution of Saddam Hussein. Tomorrow, we visit with the man who conducted the first prolonged interview with the Iraqi dictator analyst, John Nelson. John Nixon is with us. I'm Lori Walsh from all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening. Arrival.